Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander. Once again, I'd like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. And today we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program once again. He comes on every other week. And Alan, thanks again for joining the program.
Well, thanks for having me again, Stuart.
Well, Alan, it's a lot of things that we can discuss in regards to the elections, which are coming up in a few months. Actually, we'll be having primaries in many states, and then we'll be having the midterm elections at the end of the year. And the issues that we're dealing with, there's many big issues out there. And what we're going to be talking about today will be many of the issues, and challenges facing left candidates for election 2014. Now, myself, I ran as a candidate for lieutenant governor here in California in 2006. I ran on a national level, but also in 2010, I ran for governor here in the state of California. And, of course, California is a very big state with 38 million people, a lot of issues to deal with. But even in every other state in, here in the United States, there's many issues that we're faced with. But, Alan, I'm going to start the program now today looking at some information that you have with the New Progressive Alliance. And at the top of that, you say for election 2014, decorporatize Congress in 2014. Explain to our listeners when you say decorporatize Congress for 2014. What is that all? What is that about?
Well, it means that we got to start finding candidates that are that will push a people's program for peace and social and economic justice rather than vote for these same old Democrats and Republicans that are bought off and bribed by the corporations. And, you know, if we look at the situation in this country today, it's very difficult to find any of the politicians or candidates running, even for, you know, if you go down to the county and city level even, but then if you get to the state level and the federal level, it's very seldom you find a candidate that isn't bought off by these corporations. And we're the only answer to this is that people got to start running for office themselves, working people on a working-class agenda that puts peace at the top and a program for creating jobs and a real living minimum wage, you know, a basic income guarantee. And then at the local level,
right,
you got all kinds of problems that people are going to have to deal with. This country has literally gone to hell in the last 20 or 30 years. You know, the potholes, anybody can drive down the streets of any city in this country practically. And, you know, the potholes are something else. I saw a picture on the Internet the other day, guys that were fixing potholes in Detroit, their truck was stuck in a pothole themselves. You know, so, you know, these are all serious problems. And,
right,
you know, we've got to begin to get in, people have to get involved and begin to deal with these problems themselves and to find solutions. Otherwise, the situation is just going to get worse because these people in power, the only thing they care about is Wall Street and Wall Street's profits, and that's their sole purpose for being in office, is to push Wall Street's agenda. And, it, you know, you can look right down to the city and county level and you find the same thing. There's very, just a decent-sized city, you know, of a couple hundred thousand people, you're talking a couple hundred thousand dollars just to run for office. And,
right,
you know, that's what they raise. We can't raise that kind of money. We got to organize people to fight that power of money. And,
right,
you know, that's what we need. And that's what we say when we got to decorporatize Congress. And it's
well,
the only way we're going to do it.
I can understand when you talk about even those issues, even dealing with potholes, because they're across the country. I heard Sam Yorty, he was talking about potholes back in the 60s and 70s, And then you had Tom Bradley. When he ran for office, he was in office for 20 years in Los Angeles, and I ran as a candidate for California. I ran as a candidate for mayor of Los Angeles in 1989. And in that election, they were even talking about all the potholes. But during his career in office, when Tom Bradley was the mayor of Los Angeles, he was talking about 40,000 potholes that they had to repair in that city. And I can tell you, even today, they still haven't even touched half of them. So it's always a big problem. Now, I see what you say. You say decorporatize Congress in 2014, which that in itself seems like a massive undertaking, because this Congress, it's owned by corporate America, and they're financed, they're back, and they do completely the biddings of corporate America. But, Alan, I see here, I'm looking at the platform. It says the unified platform provides a model for progressive candidates. And part of that model, one of the things when I endorsed the platform when I was running for president in 2012, and I've been very supportive of this platform, you say peace first. So I'm going to get into a few of these things because, let's just go, you know, line by line. You says peace first, and then you says full employment at a living wage, saving the environment, a real social safety net. And I'm going to go each one of these. Let's start with peace first. What is, when you explain part of the unified platform, how does that fit in with every candidate running on a local, state, and national level?
Well, I don't think it's possible for anybody to run for public office on a progressive agenda if they don't put peace first. And the reason for this is, first of all, wars that are being fought are just totally wrong. They're imperialist wars. They're costing us, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars. The militarism, the constant buildup with the militarism, the foreign military bases, over 800 foreign military bases around the world, this is a huge squandering of the wealth of this country. And we can't solve any of the other problems unless we start to reorder the priorities away from war and military spending and towards meeting the needs of the people. And so therefore, you know, for anybody, you know, all these Democrats, they come and say they're going to do this and they're going to do that. But then, you know, when it comes time to doing things, they say, oh, there's no money. Well, yeah, there's no money if they're going to start these wars and, you know, police the world to protect Wall Street's profits and assets. And, you know, that's why there's no money. And they will never admit that. This is the Achilles heel of the Democratic Party. We have all these Democrats now. Hillary Clinton is going to run on a populist economic agenda when she runs for president. And, you know, you have these people like Robert Reich and even Bernie Sanders. They're talking about a populist economic agenda, but if you notice, they never talk about peace. Where are they going to get all this money? They talk, well, we'll tax the rich. Well, you know, we saw what happened here in Minnesota. We have a governor, Mark Dayton, the main plank in his platform. He went all over the state talking about, if I'm elected, we're going to tax the rich. He gets elected. What did he do? He cuts the taxes for the rich. He didn't tax the rich. And the rest of these Democrats aren't going to do that either. You know, Obama's not talking about taxing the rich anymore. He's cut the taxes for the rich. And part of the solution is twofold. We got to end this militarism and the wars so we have the resources to do the things that need to be done in this country, whether it's for the potholes or take care of schools or build schools or anything else. The other thing is if we don't have enough with the peace dividend, then we need to tax the rich. And we should be looking at really taxing the rich, not just talking about it, but really taxing the rich. And none of these politicians have done anything as far as bringing forward legislation that will change the taxation in this country so that rich really get taxed. And this is a big, big problem. And but peace is the main thing, because if we can't solve our problems through peace, we're not going to solve them by taxing the rich. We'll never build the kind of movements that are necessary to tax the rich if we can't build a movement for peace. Now, this is just sort of common sense.
Well, I mean, we saw the Democrats, and we looked at their agenda back in 2007 and 2008, and they were talking about peace and, you know, and creating more money for these social programs or whatever. But, I mean, how are people not going to be deceived again when we heard the same crapola from Obama, you know, and his group, and then we're probably going to hear the same thing from Hillary, you know, and her group. Bernie Sanders, we hear him talking about how he's going to do all this, but he's not calling for us to end these wars or whatever. But Alan, when we're talking about peace, I mean, you know, from one side we hear them talking about peace, but then they have a separate agenda. How do we ensure that we're not fooled once again?
Well, there are no guarantees. It's just that people have to be out there running for office themselves and constantly challenging these politicians, and we've got to put peace out there. Even the peace movement, the peace movement got sucked in by Obama, and, you know, the same people that supported Obama from the peace movement and from the labor movement, even the environmental movement and the civil rights movement, these people all got sucked in by Obama. They're now being sucked in, you know, with all this rah-rah-rah for Hillary Clinton, the first woman president. And
right.
They're pushing, you know, I read the stuff put out by Robert Borisash from the Campaign for America's Future. They're talking about this populist economic agenda that they're building around. Robert Reich is talking about the same thing, Bernie Sanders. But none of them have included peace in that agenda. And I just, you know, I'd like, you know, I've written to Robert Borisash. He used to answer me all the time. He never answers me anymore because, you know, I'm pushing this issue of how do you deal with the economy of this country without talking about peace. And if you look at any of these groups, none of them are talking about peace, not even the peace organizations. It's pathetic.
Right, exactly.
And
Alan, I mean, you keep bringing up Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's not even talking about shutting down this war machine that's going on full blast. And people are talking about supporting Bernie Sanders for 2016. They're talking about Hillary. But the thing is, I don't even see this with many of the other candidates that are running for the local offices, running for the state offices. And this is very important that anyone, and I'm going to talk about some of the candidates that you have already, that this organization, the New Progressive Alliance, has already have that support of those candidates. I want to find out which one of those candidates are talking about peace as well. But Alan, it seemed like this is the direction. This is something that every candidate running on a progressive platform, they should be talking about peace first. It makes sense.
Right. And even on the local levels, peace has to be talked about. One of the problems that I see is that these foundation-funded outfits are sort of determining the agenda for a lot of people's organizations at this point. And what people don't really look at is the money behind these foundation-funded outfits. These are the philanthropists. They call themselves philanthropists, but who are they really? They're the very people that are profiting from these wars and the destruction of the environment and everything else. And then they turn around and they say, we're going to donate some of our money to these movements and organizations. What they're doing, they're not donating anything. They're buying silence so that people don't oppose what they're doing. This is what's happening
exactly
in this country. And anybody can see that. You can look at the different budgets from peace organizations and see they're getting massive contributions from the Rockefeller Brothers Funds, the Ford Foundation, you know. These people are not going to put up money for a peace agenda. That's common sense. These people are making billions of dollars in profits off of wars. These are the war profiteers. You know, they're buying off people so they don't fight against militarism and wars and to close down these foreign military bases. And so these people say, you know, we're running for school board. Peace has nothing to do with that. Well, you know, fund our schools, not the war. You know, when are we going to start telling the generals to go out and hold the baked goods sales and sell flower seeds and vegetable seeds and candy bars door-to-door to finance their wars and put that money towards our schools? this is the way all these things are connected. And if people aren't going to talk that way.
And not having any recruitment, not having speaking up against any recruitment of young people on campus to support these wars.
Right. And, you know, you got the recruiters coming into the schools, and you got the recruiters. There was a big article in the newspapers, I don't maybe 3 months or so ago, but where there was this big scandal going on. These recruiters were paying off high school principals for telling them what students to go and contact who would be most likely to join the Army and the military and everything, you know. This is the kind of filthy corruption we got going on in this country. What kind of, you know, counselors and principals would take bribes from military recruiters to send the kids that they're supposed to be educating off to war? This is, you know, the sickest thing I ever heard of. That scandal sort of died down, but...
Yeah, I agree. Alan, I see right here you say full employment at a living wage. Now, that's huge. I mean, right now, let's face it, we have 20 million people in this country, as I speak, that are unemployed. And forget about the phony numbers that we get at the end of every month that we're going to get in a few days showing that, you know, how well the economy is improving because, again, we know that's crapola. But, Alan, we have 20 million people that are unemployed, people that are working part-time jobs, you know, two people doing the job of one. But, Alan, when I look at this right here, full employment at a living wage, how are we going to accomplish this? And what type of jobs are we talking about creating? Obviously, we're not talking about jobs of flipping burgers.
Well, you know, in my opinion, even the jobs flipping burgers, they should be good jobs paying real living wages.
Good point. I don't mind flipping burgers if I'm getting paid $20 an hour. I'll flip burgers
exactly.
all day.
And there's no reason why somebody working at McDonald's shouldn't be making, you know, $22, $23, $24 an hour. The thing is, the absurdity of the whole thing is that McDonald's, with their profits and what they pay their stockholders and everything, they could easily pay that to their workers, and it would only make a small dent in their profits, you know.
Right.
But they're so greedy that they won't do this. But when we say we want full employment, we're talking about we need some kind of full employment legislation that would require the President and Congress to work together to attain and then maintain full employment. This is what was talked about in 1945 with the Full Employment Act.
Well, Alan, how do we get that down to a city and state level? Because the politicians that we're going to see out in the streets campaigning, these are going to be people running for, you know, school board, running for city council, running for mayor of these cities, you know, running for various local offices. So how do we get this message to people that are running on a local office that we need full employment and a living wage? Because we see it happening in Seattle. We already see this happening. How do we get that same thing happening here on a local level?
Well, I think that the people that are running, we have to have people running for office that are going to, you know, be the voice of the millions of people in this country that want peace and they want the priorities of this country reordered. I mean, face it, there's no way that our schools are going to get the money they need unless, you know, the priorities are reordered at the federal level. We're not going to solve any of these problems unless those priorities are reordered from the federal level. And this needs a, you know, a massive campaign in this country. That's why everybody running for political office, whether it's city council, or school board, or county commission, has to be bringing up this issue of peace. And, the programs that are going to create jobs in this country are things like we need a national public health care system. This would create 12 to 15 million new jobs in this country and provide the American people with free health care at centers all in their neighborhoods and communities across this country. We need a national public child care system. You know, Obama and all these people talk about preschool and child care and everything, but, you know, we need a national public health care system.
Is Obamacare going to provide millions of jobs?
No, we've already seen that Obamacare is responsible for eliminating jobs. Every day, practically, you can read in the paper where there's some company that's found a scheme to use Obamacare as an excuse to put their employees on part-time basis, and so they can evade paying for their health care and everything. I mean, these are huge. These aren't small businesses. These are major corporations. Corporations like Menards, you know, corporations like Taco Bell. These are huge corporations that are using Obamacare as an excuse to put people on part-time employment. And you know.
So anyway, what you're saying is, if we have a national, healthcare program, this is going to create the more than 10 to 12 million jobs, good-paying jobs, correct?
Correct. And it's you know, there's nothing controversial. People say, oh, you know, you can't talk about that because it's socialism, and you know. Realistically, we are talking about socialized health care, but let's, you know, what it really is a national public health care system. And the reason I use those terms is because it has to be modeled on the same thing that our public schools are modeled on. Public financing of the health care system, public administration of the health care system, and public delivery. We would never think of you know, sending our kids to school with a $10 bill and say, pay your teacher for what you learned today. You know,
right.
Nobody would think of doing anything like that. So, you know, public schools work and they function to the extent that they're properly financed. And, you know, we could do the same thing with health care. For sure, we could do the same thing with child care. There's no reason not to model a child care system after public education. We don't need these private providers of child care. And that would create 3 to 5 million jobs. Plus, you know, when we talk about local politicians, you know, what's their role in all of this? They should be demanding that the government start a Workers' Progress Administration, that they start that up again, and a CCC program and a CETA program, the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, so that, you know, that would enable them to have the workers that are required to fill these potholes and everything. You know, and we face it, we can't be bombing holes in other countries while and filling potholes in our own communities at the same time.
Good.
There's just no
Very
way to do
point.
That. And so, you
saving the environment. Saving the environment. That's a huge one there.
Here again, the militarism and war is connected to that, because the military-industrial complex leaves the largest carbon footprint of any other industry in the world. And at the same time, you know, we're destroying the environment through this militarism. They say that 40% of all the iron ore that's been mined on the Iron Range, and that's the world's largest producer of iron ore, is on the Iron Range here in Minnesota. 40% of all that iron ore has gone into either preparing for war, or rebuilding in the aftermath of war. You know, that's something to think about, the millions and millions of tons of iron ore that have been mined have been wasted on wars in the last 100 years. You know,
how many states, Alan, are affected by this Keystone XL project, where they're going to be putting this pipeline all the way from Canada down to the Gulf? There's got to be at least a dozen states. Am I accurate in that?
Well, I would guess far more than a dozen, because part of that Keystone pipeline comes down here through Minnesota. Well, it's not. It's from the tar sands, and that pipeline comes down through Minnesota, and it goes even down to near Chicago, where they process this stuff. So these are pipelines that are going all over this country. They're leaking all over the place. This is a terrible environmental mess.
And it's going to create a future disaster. What are some of the candidates that are running for, like, even the state offices in that area? And I'm certain there's probably some left candidates somewhere in that within the area of that region of that pipeline. What are they? Do you see them on the front line speaking out against that pipeline?
Well, some of the Green Party candidates are at this point, and
right. And I saw the arrest, which you know, I admire them for standing up against it. But the Green candidates.
You know, the environmental movement has weakened itself by not joining with the peace movement on this whole issue of the environment. What is, you know, that if we didn't have this huge military machine, for sure we wouldn't even need that oil from the tar sands. And, you know, so we're wasting all these resources left and right on militarism and wars. and people are, they got to begin to connect all these dots, because you can't just look at things very narrowly and say, you know, I'm running for county commission, and that issue of the pipeline doesn't affect me, and the wars don't affect me, you know, and my constituents, because militarism and wars are a very local issue. There's, I don't think there's any communities in this country where production isn't going on for militarism and wars. Up here in rural northern Minnesota, there's a outfit called Matt Tracks, and they started making these rubber tracks for ATVs and pickup trucks and everything, and that was supposed to be for recreation. But then the Pentagon got a hold of this company, and they gave them $1 million, and they started giving them more and more money. And pretty soon this company built a huge factory over in China, and now they're making all this equipment that can go through the desert and into the, you know, the areas in the wintertime, and for the military, for military equipment. And, you know, left and right, you just look at all these industries. Just 20 miles from us, we got an outfit called Polaris. They're known for their snowmobiles. Well, they also make ATVs, and now they're producing thousands of these ATVs for the military. You know,
right.
So it's, we've, our country, it's, you know, Nazi Germany became militarized just like this. All the industries were geared up for the military, and that's what happened, has happened in this country. And
right.
Nothing is for human producing for human needs anymore, or for the protection of the environment. And until that happens, we're not going to create the jobs that we need in this country. You know, we got to look at solving the problems of the people as a way to create jobs. All these people that talk about, well, if you put people to work, it puts money in their pocket, and then they spend the money, and it keeps the economy going. They look at it as a means to, these Keynesian economists, they look at jobs as a way to keep the economy going. We got to look at creating an economy that serves the needs of the people, that whether it's goods or services, whatever is needed for you know, human needs and to make a better life for people, that's what we should be producing.
Well, when you look at Keynesian economics, it's all about, you know, protecting the wealth of the super elite. It has nothing to do. And when you talk about the economy, it's their economy. It's not the economy for the people. And,
right, it's the Wall Street economy.
Right, exactly. It's the Wall Street economy. Alan, you say a real social safety net. Explain to our listeners, when you say a social safety net, what is a social safety net?
Well, that includes things like Social Security, health care, unemployment compensation, all these things that help people get through the problems of, that have been created by capitalism is what it amounts to. Things like Social Security. You know, Social Security, all these people are saying now, these politicians, they say, well, it was never meant to provide fully for people in their retirement. Well, that's just a great big lie. It was meant for that, and it was supposed to be built up into a system that would provide for all the needs of the people in their old age. That's what Social Security is supposed to be about. And now in this country, we got people, you know, that are 70, 80 years old that are having to go back to work because they can't make ends meet on their Social Security. Social Security should be increased. There's no reason it can't.
Right.
Our own government has stolen the money, you know, billions of dollars from the Social Security Trust Fund. Our own government has pilfered that Social Security Trust Fund. You know, that's destroying the social safety net. You know, you talk about Medicare and Medicaid. Unemployment
right.
compensation. Well, these people in Congress and Obama, they've been cutting unemployment insurance instead of expanding it. We should have unemployment insurance from the time somebody is laid off or until the time they're hired again. That's the kind
not,
of unemployment.
Not no 99 weeks. No 99 weeks. That's what
no.
I'm hearing.
No, it's not the fault of the person that's unemployed. You know,
right.
they should not have to pay because Wall Street is limiting the number of jobs in this country because they want a huge pool of unemployed people to drive wages down. This is not the problem of people. They have not created the problem that's made them unemployed. Wall Street has done that. And so we need an unemployment compensation program that will provide unemployment compensation from the time somebody's laid off on a job until the time they get a job. You know, there's all kinds of social programs like this that fall under the social safety net. And we got to look at
you
those
know, when
things.
You talk, when you talk about... When you talk about Social Security, I was talking to a lady over the weekend. Well, she and her husband, but when I was, she was retired and she had worked for over 30 years. And she said, well, you know, I don't have much income, but you would consider working for 30 years. Her income from Social Security was like $740 a month. You would think that, that after you have given that much, you would get a lot more, back at least help you in your gray years, but $740. Yeah. No one can live on $740 a month. That comes out to what, like 20 bucks a day?
Yeah, it's impossible. Another thing that's happening, I work with casino workers that are trying to organize, and in these casinos, you find all kinds of elderly people that have gone back to work after they've been off for a few years on Social Security, and they can't make ends meet. One of the reasons they can't make ends meet is because they're on expensive medicines. And they say they're working just to pay for their medicine. This is a criminal system that we have that would put people in this kind of situation. People tell me they have medications that cost like $30 for a little pill, and some people have to take two or three of these pills every day.
Right.
Alan,
we have, you said it's human rights and civil liberties.
Right.
This is part of the, we're still on the unified platform for the New Progressive Alliance. And this is for, any candidate seeking your endorsement, they should at least support this platform. But
right.
What is involved with the civil rights and civil liberties? And we can see that's eroding across the country for everyone. Most people still think they have constitutional rights. This Congress now says your constitutional rights are nothing more than a privilege.
Right.
But anyway, could you explain about that?
Well, we believe that we have to really enforce the Constitution of this country and the Bill of Rights. And, something has to be done to stop all this police repression and police violence against the people that's taking place. This is all about human rights and civil liberties. Our freedom of speech is constantly being limited in so many different ways. That's part of civil liberties, is extending and making sure that the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, is defended and protected. It's hard for a lot of groups now, peace and social and economic justice groups, to even get a room in a school or anything, and even in a library anymore. And I went to, there's a community room at the Roseau County Library here, a few miles from where I live. And it's always been a room that people could use for free or next to free. Now I went there and I said, we want to have a meeting about peace. And they said, well, it'll cost you $300. This is just a small room.
Alan,
the same
thing is happening here in California.
Yeah.
You
so
can
how,
walk
how
in,
you,
and, and they would get,
for
$300 they would let you for, use a room for free. All you have to do is just make sure you clean up afterwards. Now they say, well, what is your meeting going to be about? And then they're going to give you an outrageous fee. It's going to be like $250. For like 3 hours. It's ridiculous.
But here's the thing, Stuart. The Democrats and Republicans get use of these rooms for free.
Oh, right, exactly.
So how are people supposed to compete with that, So this all comes under human rights and civil liberties. They're taking, we the taxpayers pay for these to maintain these facilities and to build them and everything else, and then they're turning around if we want to have a little place to hold a meeting to discuss our problems. They're going to charge us $300 for a couple hours to hold a meeting, This is another way that our rights are being taken away.
Hear you saying is these are things that people even running on a local level, they can get involved. Like they can make certain that things like that are available to people just for meetings,
where
we can exercise our civil liberties. They can speak out against, police abuses in those communities and require more accountability from the police department. I mean, these are things that people, even on a local level, can get involved in protecting people's rights. And when it comes to jobs, these are things also from the local level all the way to the national level. We can have candidates speaking up in that regards. Alan, I'm just going to make a very brief announcement because we still have a lot to cover in the next 25 minutes here, but I just want to mention very briefly that we do have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program once again. He joins us every other week, and today we're discussing the issues and challenges facing left candidates for 2014. And Alan, thanks again for joining the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Stuart.
Alan, did you want to say something, Alan, real quick?
No.
Okay. Alan, I want to look at some of the bigger issues. All of these are big issues. None of them are small. But over the years, I've been, you know, very concerned with the prison population nationwide, and it's not diminishing. I mean, we have the largest prison population per capita in the world. We have almost 2.5 million people that are locked up in U.S. prisons and jails. I'm looking at the statistics, and these are a little bit outdated, but when I was running as a candidate in 2008, total prison population, 2,418,000 federal and state prisons. They have 1.5 million people in state prisons, territorial prisons, 13,000, local jails, 786,000, ICE facilities, 10,000. But, Alan, when I look at these numbers, these are things, again, for the prison industrial complex, and you're talking about monies that we can be using to take care of many of the social needs that we have, and here we're spending billions upon billions to incarcerate people for, you know, a lifetime in many cases, you know, and some not even for some just for minor violations. Alan, where should our left leaders, people that are running for public office, where should they stand on things such as the prison population in this country, the prison industrial complex, the three strikes laws? Where should these candidates – I was talking about this in 2006, 2008. What should the candidates be saying today?
Well, I think the candidates should be saying that it's that we're wasting a whole lot of money on these prisons for a lot less than what we spend on these prisons. And to keep somebody in a prison and in jail, we could be educating the people, and we could be putting them to work at jobs in a WPA program or CCC program, and we could eliminate probably 90% of the crime. And I don't believe most of the people that are in jail should even be in jail. They shouldn't have spent a single day in jail for their crimes. You got people on Wall Street that are bigger criminals than any of these people, and they've never spent a day in jail. You know, every once in a while they catch a Bernie Madoff, and they'll put them in jail and say, "Oh, we, you know, get the crooks at all levels." But they don't. The people that are in the prisons in this country are nothing but a bunch of poor people that have never had an opportunity to get a decent education or a job, and that's why they're in jail. And, you know, we're spending sometimes 4 and 5 times as much to keep somebody in jail as what it would cost to give them an education and give them a job. And this is what we got to start to talk about. There's big profits to be made off of this whole prison system, from telephone calls to you know, the uniforms and everything else is being private. The jails and the prisons are being privatized. The food that's being served, all of this. Corporations are making big money off of these prisons. And that's why so many people are in jail. It's profitable.
Here is another one, Alan, that a lot of people are not aware of the cost when we're talking about prisons. They have in California, we have 733 individuals that are on death row in California. Florida has 412. Texas has 292. I think almost every week that goes by, you hear about Florida executing someone. You have Pennsylvania with 197, Alabama 197, and it goes on and on. it was something was very interesting, an article that was in the paper in the LA Times back in 2006, and they looked at the estimated cost for individuals that were on death row and the cost for their appeals, the cost for housing, and the total cost for each individual for 11 individuals that have been on death row. And it, and the average cost for appeals and everything, Alan, was $224 million per individual. Alan, $224 million per individual. Most of that cost was for appeals. And most people aren't aware, California, of course, has the highest, you know, the highest cost for, you know, incarcerating someone on death row. And you know I'm completely against, you know, the death penalty. But when we talk about the prison industrial complex and we're talking about social, the social safety net, Alan, that's a big one. When we're talking about prisons and death row inmates across the country, what do you have to say about that and the costs?
Well, I'm against the capital punishment. And I don't know, you know, we haven't really examined, I don't think, who's getting all this money, but a lot of it, a big share of that you're talking about, appeals and everything, is all going to these attorneys.
Right.
And a lot of these attorneys are even, they're being paid by the government. And, you know, these attorneys are charging like $300 to $600 an hour. You know,
right.
You can't go,
exactly.
You or I, we can't go get an attorney for anything, even a speeding ticket, without paying an attorney around $300 an hour. And, you know, the whole judicial system and everything has become so corrupt, it's just I don't know, it's hard to even explain in words how bad it is. A person has to go sit in a courtroom for a day and see what happens. You know, here in northern Minnesota, over 50% of the inmates in the jails are Native American, and less than 1% of the people that are employed at jobs are Native American. You know, what does that tell you? You've got 65 to 85% unemployment on Indian reservations, and, you know, you got all these Native Americans that are in jail. The things that they're in jail for, driving without up-to-date driver's license, you know, things like this. There's dozens of people in the jails here because they can't afford the fine, so they put them in jail for driving without a license. That this is, you know, this shows the criminality of the whole judicial system. And,
right.
You know, all kinds, I mean, the pettiest of crimes they put people in jail for, and the poorest people can't get out of jail. And on top of putting the people in jail, they charge them for their jail cells and everything else, you know, that they could stay in a hotel cheaper. And there's just no end to it when you look at the prison system in this country. When you really look at it and examine it, where the money is going, it's criminal. I know they arrested me, and they dropped the charges, but it still cost me a couple thousand dollars. And I didn't
right.
even have a lawyer yet at that point. But, you know, what they do to people and put people through is something else. And then they'll go after people. The people don't pay their jail bills for their room and board and everything. They'll go after them and arrest them again. You know, what kind of crime is that for not being able to pay for a jail cell? You know, we have people that are labeled felons. Once you're labeled a felon, it's almost impossible to get a job. So what are these people going to do? They're going to. How chances are, if they want to eat and survive, they're going to go out and do something illegal again, and they put them back in jail. You know, there's no end to it. And if there weren't these big corporations making money off of the prison system right now, we wouldn't have anywhere near
business.
The number of people in jail.
Alan. We're looking at again. I'm looking at the prison, the just us system in this country, justice system. Alan, when I look at that, I look at two situations that I've followed, you know, for some time. Trayvon Martin, and he was murdered by the Zimmerman, And in addition to that, we have Marissa Alexander, and she was standing her ground as a mother against an abusive father, and now we have a district attorney who's trying to get 60 years for this young lady. But Alan, I see 23 states. 23 states have this Stand Your Ground law. Where, I mean, 23 states. When we talk about issues for 2014, that's 23 opportunities for candidates in those states to be able to stand up against that one issue, Stand Your Ground, because, first of all, in my opinion, it's very unfair. It discriminates against minorities, and we can see in this situation in Florida, we did not see justice dispensed properly for the person that committed this crime. But what is your opinion about third party candidates and dealing with this issue of Stand Your Ground?
Well, they're going to have to, third party candidates are going to have to come out squarely on the side of the people that are being oppressed and repressed in this country. The case in Florida that you're talking about, that woman has been, she was originally charged, and there was outrage because she was going to go to jail for 30 years, and because she stood up and people, for 20 years, yeah, and because she stood up and people defended her, the prosecution's going to make an example out of her and say, we're going to put you in jail for 60 years now because you stood up for your rights.
60 years.
Yeah.
Right.
And
yeah, it's 60 years because she's challenging the system.
Yeah, she's being penalized for challenging injustice. And this,
yeah.
This shows.
In other words,
you
say I want
system.
Justice, so now they're trying to throw her in prison for 60 years.
Yeah, and this is something that progressive candidates are going to have to stand up and say, this can't go on anymore in this country. These prosecutors are, besides the generals and stuff in the military, these prosecutors are some of the most reactionary people in this country. And, they're very racist in most cases. And, it has to change. But this is the corruption of the entire, from top to bottom, the system is so corrupt. No matter where you look, all you find is corruption and scandal and injustice. And it usually centers around racism. The worst injustices always center around racism, it seems like, in this country. And there's just no end to it. I would encourage people to go and sit in a courtroom just for a day and see what happens and see who the people are that are being prosecuted. And, you got to come away from a day in a courtroom and say, we got a terrible problem with racism in this country. And there's no two ways about it. And yet you got all these judges that sit up there, and half of these judges are nothing but crooks themselves.
Right.
And these are the people that are throwing people in jail. If anybody should be in jail, it should be some of these judges and the police. Look at the police. The police will come into court and lie, tell lie after lie after lie just to get a conviction.
Right.
And the prosecutors prep them. The prosecutors teach these cops to lie. They tell them
exactly
how to lie on the witness stand. And that's why one reason why we have so many people in jail that shouldn't be there is because these prosecutors are prepping the police and teaching them how to lie. Here's people that are supposed to be upholding the law, and they sit in a courtroom and raise their hands swearing, saying that they'll swear to tell the truth. And when they know that they've been told to lie,
Alan, I just read something recently where they were talking about police, things that are introduced that police departments, when they plant evidence, if they plant evidence, normally plant evidence that submitted as evidence against people trying to protect themselves. I don't know what state it was that ruled on it, but they say that it can be admitted as evidence. What, Alan, what's with that? Evidence that produced that has been deliberately a lie
and you're still going to admit it as evidence. What is this all about?
Well, it's part of the corruption of the system, and it's usually attached to racism in some way.
I don't know. Alan, you know, you just get me going if I keep talking about all this corruption here. Alan, there's a few other things that we're going to cover before the end of our program today. And Alan, again, I just want to really thank you for coming and joining us. Today we're dealing with the issues and challenges facing left candidates for 2014, and we have Alan Mackey on our program once again. Obviously, in every state, a lot of these issues, they vary state by state, like if we're talking about the Keystone XL project, the pipeline moving the tar sands, if we're dealing with issues such as stand your ground, the prison industrial complexes across the board. When we're talking about the peace issue, you know, bringing peace instead of supporting all these wars, that affects all 50 states and all territories because wars are very expensive. But these are things that the candidates need to be dealing with on a local, state level, and also candidates that are running for congressional office as well. One other issue that I want to, before we move on, Alan, that in almost every state, I believe, they have casinos. And many of these casinos you go into, these workers are just dying because, I mean, they're working in smoke-filled casinos. They're working on the conditions and just so they can make a living. Where should left candidates be dealing with that issue in those states? And it's here in California, and I'm certain it's right there where you're at, but where should left candidates be standing on this issue?
Well, working with organizing in the Indian gaming industry, you know, we've had a heck of a time getting even left candidates to understand the issue. And what people don't understand about this entire Indian game industry is that it's a really a misnamed industry because Native Americans don't own anything in this industry except for the debt. They don't own the slot machines. They don't own the table games. They don't own the hotels or the motels or the restaurants or the bars or the barber or beauty shops and the gift shops. They don't own any of this. This is all divided up between these organized crime families, and they're the ones that are profiting. And anybody can go and look and see slot machines are registered with the states just like an automobile by model and serial number. And it's told where they're on the casino floor and everything. And you'll find that not one single Native American at any of the 350 Indian gaming casinos across this country, not one single Native American owns one single slot machine, nor does any tribal government or tribal enterprise. These machines are all owned by a bunch of mobsters. And the workers are forced to work in these smoke-filled casinos. They're getting heart and lung diseases, cancers. For an elderly worker, somebody that's 65, 70 years old, to have to go to work in one of these casinos just commits them to an early death. And,
right.
You know, we're seeing this all the time, the effects of smoking. But even the loud noise in these casinos, they're not controlled anywhere near what is required by OSHA for noise levels. And noises, people, you know, don't think of this, but they think, well, you know, oh, wow, it's just fun going into a casino, listen to all this noise. But these noises, when you have to work in one of these casinos day in and day out, it's literally driving people crazy. You know, psychiatrists will tell you that that human beings weren't made to tolerate this kind of noise day in and day out. If you go into a mine where they operate a crushing machine, people are given proper equipment so that their hearing isn't destroyed and everything else. Well, casino workers don't get any kind of consideration like that because there are no protections under state or federal labor laws that protect casino workers in this Indian gaming industry. Even the United States Department of Labor will not enforce the minimum wage at these casinos. So, you know, this is a terrible situation. Almost 2 million people are now employed in these casinos. That includes the casinos, the hotels, the motels.
You say two million?
2 million across this country, yeah. These are huge, huge operations.
It is.
You know, you have the Seminoles.
I didn't realize it was that huge.
Yeah, the Seminoles right now, the Seminoles own the Hard Rock Casino Empire, the Seminoles in Florida, and they're looking to get a new license of the compact. They're looking to get the compact extended for their casinos, and I've written a letter saying that that compact should not be extended unless they agree to insert workers' rights, all state and federal protections into that compact, and they eliminate smoking and control the noises to the levels required by OSHA. And so far, not one single newspaper in Florida has printed that letter to the editor that I wrote in response to the attorney promoting the extension of that compact, the attorney working for the Seminoles. And, you know, it just shows the way working people are being treated in this country. To make somebody work in a place without any rights, you know, you can't hardly describe it. It's the worst kind of way that workers can be treated is what is being done in the Indian gaming industry. And you're working for outright mobsters. People get slapped and beat up. You know, I've had women come to me and say, you know, my manager slapped me because I told him I wasn't going to do this or do that. And I had when I was working in the casino, I had a supervisor come up to me and tell me what he tried to make me work three shifts, 24 hours straight. I told him he wasn't going to do it. And he said, you know, I can find an effing retard to do your job if you don't want to work. This is the way they talk to them in these casinos. And it's a terrible, terrible place to have to work. And I wish that a lot more people would start working in these casinos just to see what's going on. It's an education in itself. But candidates should be demanding that these casinos and the compacts have to include workers' rights protected under state and federal labor laws. That should be the position of the left-wing candidates, and that these casinos go smoke-free. One of the problems.
Alan, I have 4 minutes to wrap a few things up here. I noticed that you say that you have more than 60 candidates have endorsed the unified platform for the New Progressive Alliance. Is that correct?
Yeah, but that's not for this election cycle. That includes.
I see candidates endorsed for 2014. When you say 2014, Peace and Freedom candidate Cindy Sheehan, did NPA endorse her?
Yeah, because she endorsed our platform.
Okay, March 2014, Green candidate Paul Glover, running for governor of Pennsylvania. You endorse Paul Glover?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with him, but we endorsed him.
So
I'm familiar
he endorsed,
with Lena
okay,
Buggs.
Good. And I noticed Green Party candidate Lena Buggs running for Minnesota State District 65 also endorsed the Unified Platform.
Right. Lena Buggs is a great candidate. We need more candidates like her. She's a working-class woman, and she's been fighting for civil rights and workers' rights for years. And, you know, we're real proud to endorse Lena.
I have around 2 minutes, and then I want you to give you contact information. Alan, we always appreciate having you coming on. Put out a small survey, had probably a couple dozen people respond to it. Candidates for 2016, you have people. I'll just mention the ones that have thrown their name out there. Jesse Ventura, he's as a presidential candidate. What do you think?
Terrible. I think he's.
Okay.
we had him here as a governor.
I agree. Bernie Sanders. I see a lot of buzz out there about Bernie Sanders. What do you think? You always see me. I say I pass. But what is your opinion?
Well, that's pretty much my opinion too. He's just supported Obama's position on the Ukraine, so.
Time and time again, he supports Obama. I mean, I can't see any progressive or left candidate supporting anything that Obama is doing. And, just recently, someone had put me on some site for Bernie Sanders, and, I always say the same thing. I pass, and then they deleted me off the site. So I say, that's good. So,
yeah.
Well,
yeah,
It was good.
I have mixed feelings about Bernie Sanders because I like the guy. I like what he says about Wall Street and everything. But, progressives are going to have to talk to him and talk to him very frankly and say, we're not going to support you if you keep supporting the things that these Democrats are doing.
Alan, how can people reach you?
They can call me at 218-386-2432 or they can just Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and they'll come across my Podunk blog with all my contact information there.
Well, thanks again for joining the program again, Alan. I want to thank our listeners. Always like to thank Ruth Ann Amatafil for supporting this program. And we look forward to having everyone to join us next week on the Socialist Insight. Thanks again. Have a good night, everyone.
Okay,
good night,
thanks,
everybody.
Bye.
Tonight we will not have dialectics, but Nick and or Zach will be back next Monday night. So have a good week, everybody. Good night.